Oil. I'm an article to come on, Oak. And as my clock, a merry bank. Agus, I'm a tall lever, gave on the show, yach three, wo, a shound shenna, the nurse my clock, you want to grab it. It is scrivig le Angus MacLennan and a Sparrowhu, you got over 20 crossbows. A cousin who could you. I'm assuming you could have had my yachtry on the nurse. I got a 3 liter in Akam Sunny Horse Scriva called New York on Canada. An old soldier. Angus MacLennan, 1860, who related the following story in a letter to a relative in Canada, was born at 20 Crossbows, and his family emigrated to Scotchtown, Quebec, Canada in 1862, when he was only 2 years old. His family at that time consisted of his father, Mother MacLennan, 1821 to 1902, his mother, Betty or Bess MacLeod, 1831 to 1902, they both died the same year. And then his older sister, Catherine, and himself, just the four of them. 6 more children were born to the family in Canada. Angus MacLennan's maternal grandfather, Angus MacLeod, 12 Gravel, born in 1790, emigrated along with the MacLennan family. He was then aged 72 years and a widower. He died in Canada in 1874, aged 84 years. His wife, Christina, daughter of Angus MacLean, 35 Gravel, had passed away in 1858, and he left 3 daughters in Gravel. Ishbel, who was married to John Nicholson, 32 Graven. Effie, who was married to John Nicholson, 9 Limroy, at 12 Graven. And Christina, who was married to Murdo MacMillan, 3 Graven. During the Napoleonic Wars, Angus MacLeod, my grandfather, from 12 Graver, was involved in the fighting in Spain, and the French army under the best generals of Napoleon were flushed with one continuous round of victories for years, and that is over their best enemies on the mainland of Europe. The British used Lisbon, Portugal, as their base, and under their commander Sir John Moore, they made a fierce thrust at the French, but the British commander was killed, and his men were forced back to Lisbon. Then one Arthur Wellesley, a Dublin Irishman, was put in command of the British. Having driven the British for cover, the French were keen to renew the fighting and finish off their enemies, the British. But they felt that the British under Wellesley were reluctant to fight. In actual fact, Wellesley was only training and preparing his army for the fierce battles that actually culminated in the British in the French being driven out of Spain at the point of the bayonet, only able to fight a rearguard action. Wellesley was then made the Duke of Wellington, and he was known as the Iron Duke. One soldier who gave a fine account of himself in that war was Kenneth Murray, who, like my grandfather, was a Louisman, although a few years older. As a youth, Kenneth took strongly to sports, and while he was yet young, quite young, he went to sea, where he learned lots of capers peculiar to the briny, and in Liverpool he he learned to box and fight. He grew up to be a fine-looking big man, good-natured, and a natural comedian. Being well known among the sailors, he was taken on by a Scot who kept an alehouse in a French port as an entertainer and to teach his patrons the sports and pastimes of Scotland. Kenneth soon learned to speak French like a native, and he was held in great esteem by his boss. When, however, the war broke out, Kenneth went straight home and enlisted in the British Army. Kenneth and Angus became great friends, and in the course of time, the army discovered that Kenneth had the qualifications of a fine scout. On many occasions, he was sent through the enemy lines for information. He, being dark-haired and able to speak French fluently, enabled him to mingle with Frenchmen without attracting attention. During the retreat, the French army suddenly halted and made a show of fight. The wily Wellington could never be lured into a trap, and he had a suspicion that the enemy had received reinforcements. So he halted too, and once more sent out our man, Kenneth, to see what was going on. Up to this time, Kenneth always worked alone on these trips, but had felt at times that a good pal would be to his advantage. So this time, he chose my grandfather, a big, lively, dark-haired fellow like himself. These brave men knew very well that if they were caught, it was sure death, but they did not falter. Garbed in the costume of the French peasants, they worked their way through the French lines deeply under cover of darkness, and found the French army in a worse plight than they had expected. The four major battles of Vittorio, Valedictal, Saragossa, and Salamanca, fought in Spain, had thinned their ranks. Reinforcements had not arrived. The rear guard spread out with great show, was nothing but a thin screen, and they were hard put for a rest. Hence the stand they made. The fortunes of war had only gone against them. The fortunes of war had truly gone against them at last. With this and other valuable information, the boys hit back with all possible speed, travelling in fields and roads at night, and sleeping in barns and haystacks during the day. They subsisted on what they were able to get. One night on their return trip, they were following the least travelled of two roads leading back to their own lines, and were almost there when they heard the tramp of horses ahead of them. The two men struck across the fields to the other road, But the same unpleasant sound greeted their ears. More horsemen there. Daylight was close at hand. They had spotted a haystack in a farmer's barnyard, and back there they went, got into the stack at the first rays of the morning. Feeling secure, and the odour of the hay being sweet, they soon slept. They were so close to the British lines that they heard the bugle calling the soldier, so near and yet so far. Again the unwelcome sound of horses' feet was heard by the boys. They awoke to see a troop of five horsemen approaching the their haystack. The horsemen secured a rope which they tied around the haystack. To the rope they tied their horses. One man was left in charge and the rest went into the farmer's house. That hay must have tasted as sweet as its odour, for the horses made fast inroads into it. It wasn't very long until the boys could feel the haystack begin to rock. Something must be done quickly to remain in the haystack, because if it fell over, it would be disastrous. Kenneth finally whispered his plans to his pal Angus, and watching his chance, leaped down on top of the unlucky Frenchman, crushing him to the ground. Then quickly bound and gagged him. Then they each took a fine horse and made for the road. They came to a fence. Kenneth jumped down and made an opening. When they had taken the horses through the hole, Kenneth told Angus to beat it. He would stick something of a barricade in the hole of the fence to check anyone who might pursue them. Kenneth, the faithful hero, was willing to sacrifice himself in order to get the report to his commander. Suddenly, Kenneth realized that three horsemen were bearing down on him. They had come through a gate the boys had not known about. Kenneth went to mount his horse, but something went wrong, and he was thrown to the ground. Springing to his feet, though half stunned, he made for the small patch of timber close by, that's trees. One of the Frenchmen, seeing his plight, took after him, sword in hand. And although Kenneth was a fast runner, the horse was faster and overtook him a few yards from the woods. The Frenchman made a swipe at Kenneth to cut off his head, but Kenneth ducked his head and turned quickly like a hare before the hound. The Frenchman, in turning so quickly, caused his horse to stumble. It fell and broke its neck, pinning the rider's leg under him. Kenneth pounced on him like a wolf and took his sword and pistol from him. The fortunes of war are at times fickle. A minute before, the Scotsman was close to being decapitated. But now the Frenchman, a fine-looking officer, was at the Scotsman's mercy. Mercy, the young fellow asked, and mercy he received. Kenneth, in his good-natured, smiling way, asked him in clear French, was he hurt, and dragged him clear of the fallen animal. Then he handed him his sword and started for the woods. The Frenchman told him it would be useless for him to try to escape. "Your best plan," said he, "would be to surrender to me, and everything possible will be done for you tonight." Kenneth had good reason to believe that Angus had got through safely through. If he had, it was certain that the Iron Duke would come to his rescue like a flash. So he thanked his late enemy, and by that time a host of Frenchmen were seen coming towards him. As Kenneth was leaving for the shelter of the timber, the young officer wished him luck and warned him not to let on that he could speak French. A mob of people was soon at hand, but Kenneth kept them off until two cavalry officers returned, and then Kenneth surrendered to the captain in command. He was questioned,
but Day would divulge nothing. They took him back to the farm, the mob clamouring for his life, but the captain told the mob that the military ethics would stand. But one way to dispose of a spy was to be shot at sunrise. To appease the wrath of the mob, he tied a rope round Kenneth's chest, hitched it to the saddle of the horse, and away they went with Kenneth for several rounds of the field. Kenneth kept his feet for a while, but again the horse promised his superiority, and proved Kenneth was dragged to the joy of the mob. When they let him loose, he came up smiling and eating the top of a turnip he had grabbed in his teeth. Hanging on to the rope with his hand saved him from injury. He promptly saluted the crowd, and like a flash turned several handsprings and performed some of his sea antics. Then he rolled a cartwheel on his hands and feet over to the thickest part of the crowd. It seems that he well understood the love of the French for the spectacular, and that bunch of French people were all of a sudden turned from enemies to friends. They gave him food, and he heard many remarks in his praise. Some even thought he ought not to be shot, but kept in prison for the duration of the war. When the captain started away with him, he began to throw kisses to the girls, to the amusement of them all. So intense was the feeling for him that some of the women even wept. In the meantime, the Iron Duke was busy. Upon receiving the report from Angus, he quickly decided what to do. Taking the main portion of his troops, which outnumbered the French, he went along the enemy's flank. When he arrived about the centre, he gave the order, "Strike through with all your ferocity and vigour." The order was carried out so quickly and fiercely that the French enemy was cut in two. The remaining portion of the troops, of the British troops, attacked the rear of the French army, which surrendered. Our heroic Kenneth was safe and sound. Now, these things are written purely from memory, and the men that conveyed them to me carried them in their memories for many a year, and it is possible that some of it is not strictly correct. Now, that's the end of the tale of the two spying soldiers. Kenneth Murray from somewhere in Louis, and Angus MacLeod from 12 Gravel. In another letter, Angus MacLennan sent to one of his young relatives in 1937. He explained some of his own experiences as follows. I grew up in a newly settled country. My father's house stood hard by our beloved Salmon River, where the youngest member of the clan lives to this day, at Scotchtown, Quebec. You will remember that his father was Mordo MacLennan, who emigrated from 20 years. There also I grew up with a sturdy, fun-loving bunch that took to sport in the river like young ducks to the water. In the course of time, we became expert in swimming, boating, rafting, and added glory to our sport by courting danger, riding a block of wood or any old stick that would hold us afloat through the rapids. The proficiency required acquired by these activities in the Salmon River didn't come at all amiss to me out here in the Rockies. One summer we camped for a time at the Knocking Horse River, where that swift and turbulent river flowed out of the Kicking Horse Lake. The source of the river, however, was another lake high up in the mountains. We often went up there duck hunting, and there were a lot of them there, and Rocky Mountain goats as well. The river came down from the lake over the face of the mountain in a succession of beautiful waterfalls, flowed into the lower lake and out at the other end, and emptied into the Columbia River at Golden, 20 miles away. It was at Golden we made the raft on which we took that joyride to the mouth of the bay of the Beaver. That ride began smooth enough, but we soon got into stronger currents, and our troubles began. The raft was overloaded, which made it hard to handle. Moreover, my other four men knew nothing about rafting. My greatest trouble was to keep clear of snags and trees sticking out from the banks of the river. To tangle with one of these obstructions meant disaster. We went bowling along faster and faster as we dropped down the river and were nearing our landing place when I put three of the men ashore but kept one. We found the raft handled ever so much better, and we were in sight of Big Canyon before we knew it, and high time to land, which was no snap in that foaming current. The bank was high and steep too. Steering the corner of the raft to strike into the bank, Scotty sprang ashore with a rope, which I swung while I swung the raft round so that the other end of it struck into the bank, thus checking it. The nimble young Scotty had a turn of the rope around a tree by that time, and we were secure. The most crucial ride of my life was over. I derived such a golden kick from that ride that it is still fresh in my memory after 53 years. You'll remember, of course, that I told you of having left those men on an island, so more woodman's and raftman's crafts had to be brought into play to get them off the island. There was nothing to it to do. There was nothing to do this with but a bare axe. We eventually got on our way following the course of the Beaver, heavily loaded with our bags. That night, after a big feed of broiled meat, roast spuds and canned fruit, we were resting and smoking by our campfire when we had a visit from a snarling, roaring mounted lion. It came within 40 yards of us. I fired two shots at him, but we never took time to see whether I killed him or not. Time was precious on such a trip. Continuing our journey, we followed the Beaver River into the heart of the Selkirk Range, where it peaked out. We soon came to the headwater of the Lissiwait River. going down the western slope of the range, rough and tough, where our experiences along that river, as we followed it to the Columbia River, where the town of the river stroke now stands, 80 miles from the mouth of the Bay River, mouth of the Beaver. We were surprised to find two sturdy Scotch canoes, Canadians, building a house there. They had to come from eastern Canada by the United States, from the coast of Washington Territory. They made their way to the Columbia River, built a boat and went up the river. Old Chuck, that's a foot, was practically 65 miles yet to go, but not a morsel of food could they give us. Their own chief food was fish and game. One of these men, Douglas Macaulay, took us across the river. We followed another stream into the Gold Range, found lots of fish and three varieties of berries, so we didn't suffer from hunger. We made good time to Shusha Lake, where there was a hotel and store. A small stream took us down the Thompson River a good distance. Then more hiking to the end of the railroad at Spence Bridge, below the junction of the North and South Thompson Rivers. Reaching the coast, we took a boat from New Westminster at the mouth of the Fraser to Victoria. Now, the incentive for this long and hazardous trip was the gold rush in Australia, where Scotty and I was bound. Only we two reached Victoria. We soon had an introduction to a shipping master, both an old English sailor and sea captain. He was a congenial soul and was quite friendly towards us. He said he was sure he could find us a berth with his friend Captain O'Brien of the William H. McNeil, a full rigger of PIC-2. NS. It was the first ship to leave for Australia and was then loading at Hastings Mill over on Barossa Inlet, which place is best known in this day and age as Vancouver, British Columbia. It was Barossa. For the next two weeks, we had a grand time picking fruit close by and taking it in, a barn dance every few nights. Caribou Cameron, perhaps the most famous man that ever lived in British Columbia, was sure to be at these dances, and there was no one more jolly and sociable than he. This gent was another Canadian Scotsman. He went to California in the gold rush of 1849, but he didn't add very much to his wealth there. He then went to Australia with no better luck. When he returned to the Pacific coast, however, he made an immense fortune in the Caribou mines. He settled in Victoria and doled out his money as free as the flowing water. Being a man of the common people, he loved to mix with them at these dances. He told us boys how we would find things in Australia, and that he was sure we would return to British Columbia, the most glorious land under the sun. And boys, when you want one, come to Old Caribou. I am still working a mine up the Fraser. He was then 64 and died 4 years later up at his mine in the swift and raging Fraser. William H. McNeil, that's a ship, eventually put into Victoria or part of her crew and took us on. Scotty as an able seaman and used truly as an ordinary seaman. My first night on the Briney as a sailor is somewhat in the category of my joy ride on the raft, but I shall pass it up and state that after 77 days, some of them wild and woolly, but I shall pass it up and state that after 77 days, some of them wild and woolly, while others were equally fine, we landed in the beautiful city of Melbourne, Australia, a week before Christmas. Then we found ourselves among the ever hospitable Scottish, every one of them trying to be the first to entertain us and make us believe that all Australia was ours. The Christmas festivities were in full swing, and it was more dancing and feasting for us. But when the first day of the new year was over, these people were at work like so many beavers, each man back to his vacation, some to the woods, some to the farms, and some to the vast stock ranches, and many to the mines. We went with two young native fellow Scots, over into New South Wales and took up mining claims along with those boys. We did quite well until too many went in there and ruined our water system. We then went a long way to the west, but the scarcity of water was so great that we returned to Melbourne. It was my full intention to return to British Columbia, just as dear old Caribou had said we would. We had been in company with a bunch of fine fellows out in West Australia, all sailors. Scotty was returning home to his native land, and they all shipped out on a Scottish clipper bound for London. So nothing would do but for me to go with them, which I did. I came back to America by way of Europe. I landed at historic old Quebec the following spring, and I am ashamed to say that I had not written a word home in 3 years. But I surprised them the next day after landing, and it was a mighty happy old homecoming. I found everybody well and prosperous on the farm. My parents hadn't seen me since I was 17, and I was then 21. I stood 6 feet tall and tipped the beam at close on 200 pounds. After a short stay at home, I went to Montreal, thinking I'd make for the coast in a short time. Instead, I went to work with another Scot, Rich Finley. He, too, was a clear caliber, and I stayed with him about 2 years and then returned to British Columbia. Signed, Angus McLaren. Well, only having the same sight of a bag of the turf I was doing out, I must have been Marty Hanschen, I'd claim I have off, but you know. For you, Eerste shit, dus dat doet mij de leven klimmen. Ach, de wonpjaakke dat men al met la wordt voor dan nachtig grassen was. Zo'n leven nog. Mijn nieuwe paper wil schrijven over religion and education. Dus, Anne Lennis.
Many of the characteristic features associated with Presbyterianism in Louis today came to us through the influence of the Gaelic schools of the Edinburgh Society for the Support of Gaelic Schools, which was a voluntary organisation established in Edinburgh in 1811. It was these Gaelic schools that introduced formal education to the people in their own Gaelic language, as well as sound evangelical religion. The Bible was the main textbook in the Gaelic schools, and the teachers were chosen for their piety rather than for their educational attainments. These teachers set a high moral standard, which was a good example of Christian living. The formative period of both former Gaelic education and evangelical religion in Louis was the 20 or 30 year period beginning about 1820, when Gaelic schools were planted in various parts of Louis. A Gaelic school was opened at Grave in 1822, and Gaelic schools were opened at Marwick and Lochshell in 1828, and at Cremore in 1829. A religious revival began in the island in the 1820s, and it began as a lay movement and not as a movement led by the ministers, in the early part at least. The first evangelical minister to come to Lochs was in 1831, when Reverend Robert Finlayson came. And the very first evangelical minister to come to Louis was in 1824, when Reverend Alexander MacLeod came to Oud. The full effects of the Reformation of 1560 was therefore slow to reach Louis. In 1616, Parliament ordered that schools and schoolmasters were to be provided for every parish in Scotland, with the land owner making the schools available and paying the schoolmaster's salary. But there were very few schools in the Highlands and Islands at the beginning of the 19th century, and those that did exist, like the English parish schools, charged fees, and that meant that very few parents could afford to send their children to school. Also, communications were not easy, and the parish school was far away from many of the people. The Lochs Parish School opened in Cowes in 1796. In 1833, Reverend Robert Finlayson stated in the second statistical report that only 12 people in Lochs could write, but half the people between the ages of 12 and 24 could read Gaelic. A few of the males could speak broken English. The parish school, which was a thatched building, was vacant, he said, for many years, for want of accommodation. We may be sure that the 12 people in Lochs who could write were from the taxman class. By the beginning of the 19th century, about 1801, the whole Bible, both Old and New Testaments, were translated into Gaelic and distributed in the Highlands. However, it was discovered that hundreds of Gaelic Bibles were left unopened in depots throughout the Highlands, simply because the people had never been taught to read the Bible in their own Gaelic language. The purpose of the voluntary Gaelic school, therefore, was to remedy that great need. Of the first four copies of the Gaelic Bible that came to Lochs, which was about 1820, all of them went to taxmen, one at Crosspost, Walters, Crobick, and Limerway. An indication of the spiritual condition of the people may be judged from the reaction of a man from Park who overheard his son, who was taught in the Gaelic schools, reading from the Bible. The man was said to be deeply shocked at the profanity of reading a book that was always reserved for pulpit use only. We therefore see that the original settlers at Crossbus in 1843 had no opportunity of formal education until the Gaelic school was opened at Loch Shell in 1828, about 14 years before they were evicted from there. The newly formed Fee Church of Scotland soon provided a school at Crossbus, which was the seat of their new congregation at Loch's, and Alan Ross, who was a school teacher in the parish school at Cowes before the disruption of 1843, joined the Free Church and taught at the Free Church School at Crossbus, where he was also an eminent elder of the Free Church. During the formative period of evangelization in Lewes from 1820 onwards, to which we already referred, lay preachers took a more active part in the life of the church, and later on in the social conditions of the Crofton community. They played a prominent part in the long struggle for land law reform, because by that time many of them had acquired self-confidence because of their knowledge of religion and education, and their practice of spontaneous public speaking and public praying. The characteristic features of this significant period in the history of Lewes, of the Lewes community from 1820 onwards, was Sabbath observance based on their better knowledge of the Bible. Family worship morning and evening, because people were now able to read the scriptures. Sabbath schools for the children, and regular prayer meetings in all the villages. Also, the men's day, or the question day, which came to be a feature of Presbyterianism in the island, where it is still very strong to the present day. The first men's day in Lewes was said to have taken place about 1825, at a Stornoway communion season. And the text or question was, and I quote, "The hope of the hypocrite shall perish," Job chapter 8, verse 3. The purpose of the service is fellowship and to encourage the duty of self-examination, as Scripture exhorts, and I quote, "Examine yourself whether you be in the faith." 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 5. The designation men are applied to those who were prominent in the religious life of the community. Usually they were elders of the church, who sometimes took the role of lay preachers. Friday of the communion was set aside as the question day, Wanakish Wakisnavi. Reverend Norman C. McFarlane gives more information and sketches of the men in his book, The Men of Lewes. On the occasion of the first question day at Stornoway in 1825, the brethren were asked to distinguish between the hope of a hypocrite and the hope of the child of God. The question was opened by Mr. McBean, who was at that time the inspector of the school set up by the Edinburgh Gaelic Society. A number of communicant men were then called upon by the presiding preacher to speak to the question. Speaking to the question is done spontaneously, without any prior knowledge of what the question was to be, or whether or not the speaker was to be called. Not even the presiding minister knows in advance what is to be the question for the day. The procedure is for the presiding minister to invite any communicant member in good standing in the congregation to put forward a suitable question for the day. The question is taken from the first person on his feet. After listening to the various speakers, usually about 10 men, giving marks of grace in the heart, one of the presiding preachers closes the question by reviewing the contributions and, if necessary, correcting any deviation from sound scriptural doctrine. On this occasion, it was John McCrae Macramore, who was at that time parish teacher in Ooglewis, that closed the question. When Reverend Robert Finlayson was inducted to the Lough's Parish Church at Cowes in 1831, he discovered that there were no Kirk Session and no Kirk Session records. He set about immediately putting that right, and he included Gaelic school teachers in his session. He then started regular prayer meetings in various villages in 1836, such as Ballallan, Laxey, Lulworth, Ronish, Graver and Lochshell. He also commenced a programme of catechising in his parishioners. Reverend Finlayson was held in very high esteem by the people of Lough. He used very colourful illustrations in his preaching and was in fact known as the John Bunyan of the Highlands. On one occasion he was preaching in Ishki, where he found the thatched roof of the mission house to be very, very leaky. Instead of remonstrating with the congregation, he used subtle and successful psychology. He said, "One day I met the Bible from the Ishki mission house on the road with a very sad countenance. I asked the Bible, 'Why are you so sad?' And he replied, 'I am leaving Ishkin Mission House because my pages are blackened by big drops of sooty rain coming through the thatch.' In the course of the following week, the thatched roof of Ishkin Mission House was duly repaired. The disruption of the church in 1843 and the creation of Crosbus as a crofting township happened on the same year. 95% of the people of Lewes left the established church and joined the newly formed Free Church of Scotland. The whole congregation of Lough followed their minister, Reverend Robert Finlayson, into the Free Church. That was a time of great sacrifice for both minister and people. The minister gave up his salary and his home for the sake of his conscience and his strong convictions, and the people gave up their congregational buildings and undertook to sustain their minister and build a new church and mass. At that time, the minister shouldered the responsibility of a young family of 6 children from a few months to 11 years old as follows. Reverend Robert Finlayson, 1793-1861. Lilas Macaulay, his wife, 1809-1887. Donald, 1832-1849. Robert, 1835-1849. Both these boys were drowned in Lough Erisot in 1849. Catherine, 1837, Margaret, 1840, John, 1842. The economic situation in Lough at that time was not good, and the building of a new church and manse was a formidable task for the deprived people of Lough. Mr. Finlayson could not find a house in Lough, and he had to live in Stormy for 2 years, and the service the scattered congregation of roadless Lochs, conducting open-air services in both summer and winter. At the age of over 50 years, until a new church was built at Crosbus, which was chosen by the people as the seat of their new Free Church congregation at Lochs. Mr. Finlayson served in Loughs for 25 years, the last 13 of them in the Free Church. In 1849, Providence dealt him a hard blow when his two sons, Donald, aged 17, and Robert, aged 14, were drowned in Lough Erisard when they were out fishing. Apparently, he preached on Sunday while the remains were awaiting burial. Their graves are marked in St. Colum Island Cemetery by an inscribed memorial stone. Mrs. Finlayson, Lilias Macaulay, was related to the celebrated Duncan Macaulay of Hugh Lewis. Her mother was Catherine Morrison, daughter of Ian Moore of Inishtown. Her mother's sister was married to Alastair Stronyoff at Garve on the mainland, father of the so-called outlaw known to tradition as MacAdrony. Our host in the Cayley House often related tales about MacAdrony to us, and among the things he told us was that Mrs. Finlayson harboured and fed him from time to time. A reliable church person from Cowes told us that there is a small room in the manse at Cowes, usually referred to as Closet MacAdrony, where Mrs. Finlayson used to lodge the so-called fugitive. Parents in the Cowes area used to discipline their wayward children by threatening to put them into Closet MacAdrony if they didn't behave. Well, that'll have to be looked at it once again, but perhaps we can get something out of that. Thank you very much, Mort. Stalking it, been all the health in your snowcast. She knew in Hero Wa Fichet, July 1993.